Take a second and imagine yourself as a male teenage praying mantis. You're going through all the usual trials and tribulations of adolescence. A few bumps, sure, but you're making it. Then your mother tells you about sex. Specifically the part where your future someone special will bite your head off during intercourse, causing you to thrash about wildly until you sputter into death. Someone page John Hughes because we've just found teen angst. So you're freaked, and mom just doesn't seem like someone you can trust anymore, considering you now finally know what happened to dad. So where can you turn for answers? Well, it's time for Dr. Tatiana, the animal kingdom's foremost sexpert. Dr. Tatiana is, of course, a fictional character. She's the creation of Olivia Judson, an evolutionary biologist. Judson came up with the idea while writing a story about sexual selection for the science section of The Economist. The story was a hit, so she decided to give Dr. Tatiana a bigger forum. The result is the new book, Dr. Tatiana's Sex Advice to All Creation. Considering all the complications that are linked to sex, I had to ask Judson, why do it at all?
Well, it's an interesting question because most people tend to think that we have sex to reproduce, and that's only partly true because it's possible to reproduce without having sex, and it's possible to have sex without reproducing. So, for example, there are small organisms like paramecium that everybody studies in biology class that don't increase in number when they have sex. So two individuals will sidle up to each other and they'll trade genes and then they'll swim away and there will be two genetically different individuals from what there were before, but there will not be an increase in numbers of individuals. And so sex is really about mixing up genes from different sources. And it's a very good way, very effective way of creating genetic novelty. And you know, because you get combinations of genes that have already been tested, so we know that they work. And so it's a very good way of generating novelty.
How intensively has sex been studied throughout the animal kingdom?
Sex in general is studied a great deal. It's studied from a theoretical point of view with everyone trying to work out what the benefits are. But it's also studied by scores of biologists who spend a lot of time studying the green spoonworm or the fruit fly, which is very well studied. But obviously the diversity of sexual behavior is absolutely enormous. And I would argue that probably there are all sorts of things out there that we haven't even begun to imagine yet.
In this extensive research of sex in the animal kingdom, how have, I guess what you might call social norms about gender affected the way that we look at this research or how we observe it?
Well, I think that one of the things that is surprising to people who are not biologists is the fact that humans are displaying a pretty small repertoire of possible sexual behaviors. So we like to think of ourselves as unique in a number of respects, that only humans have homosexuality, only humans have sex for fun, only humans masturbate. And none of that is true. Many other organisms engage in all sorts of those behaviors, and also a much wider range of behaviors that we don't do at all, like, you know, eating your lover after sex and that sort of thing. And I think that humans like to make there are a lot of gender stereotypes, like, you know, he likes to seduce girls and she likes to look after babies and all of that sort of thing. And when you look at what goes on in nature more broadly, you discover that, well, I mean, that's just total nonsense. I mean, there's enormous variation in who looks after children and in who is promiscuous and who isn't. And it's really extraordinary. I mean, in many fish, for example, it's the male who does all of the parental care. There's one of my favorite examples is a splashing fish that lives in Central and South America. It's very unusual in a number of respects because the fish lay eggs out of water, which is a strange place for a fish to lay eggs. They lay it on leaves that overhang rivers, and they jump up together, and she lays an egg, and he sprays sperm, and then they fall back into the water, and they do this over and over again until they've laid lots of eggs. And then she swims off, and she finds another male and does it again. He, meanwhile, comes back for several days and he splashes the eggs with his tail to keep them wet. And one of the things that I love about this is that if it's raining, he gives himself the day off.
So it's a pretty smart fish in a sense.
Well, absolutely. No. I think it's important not to underestimate the complexity of the behaviors.
So what are some of the more common tricks or tactics employed to win the sexual game?
Oh, well, it's extremely difficult to generalize. One of my, some of what goes on out there is really pretty mind-boggling. I think my favorite example is the green spoonworm, which has one of the largest known size differences between male and female. The female is 200,000 times larger than the male, and he spends his whole life sitting inside her fertilizing eggs.
Wow.
So, you know, it's...
Now that's having a guy underneath your thumb.
Well, absolutely. And the thing about it that I find great is the fact that this is all determined environmentally. So when you're a baby green spoonworm, you have no sex. And whether you become male or female depends on whether you meet a female during the critical window. So in the first 3 weeks, if you meet a female, you become male and you spend your whole life fertilizing eggs. And if you fail to meet a female, you become female yourself. Be host to these extremely tiny little fellows.
You know, when I was reading through the book, and in the book, you go through a number of different species and the various tricks and tactics and all the things that are involved in the whole process. It struck me that some of our closest animal relatives, both genetically, like chimpanzees, but also I think ones that we kind of feel like we have some sort of, affinity with, like dolphins, are also the ones that are involved in some of the craziest things, like, female chimpanzees, get around like you wouldn't believe. And dolphins, well, aren't all that discriminant about how they pleasure themselves.
Well, I think that's quite right. I mean, the female chimpanzee has been recorded mating with 8 different males in 15 minutes. That doesn't seem to be especially unusual. And sometimes you see photographs of a female chimpanzee with a sort of queue of males, each waiting their turn. And dolphins are extraordinary. I mean, not only do they gauge in both homosexual and heterosexual with other dolphins, they also will attempt to copulate with sharks, turtles, eels, and occasionally humans as well. I mean, it's certainly, divers sometimes get hassled by amorous dolphins.
That just doesn't sound pleasant. You know, you're on some sort of tropical vacation and all of a sudden you've been taken advantage of by a dolphin.
Yes, well, there was a case in Britain a few years ago where a guy was prosecuted for molesting a dolphin, and I'm not so certain that it shouldn't have been the other way around.
There might have been more to that story.
Absolutely. I would imagine that the dolphin made the first move.
Before, you mentioned how homosexuality is not something that's unique to humans. So what do we know about it in the animal world?
Well, we certainly know that it occurs. It occurs in a wide range of species. There's a lot we don't know about it as well. We know very little about the extent to which it is exclusive, by which I mean not bisexual. So, for example, and really that's, with respect to homosexuality and genetics, that's the mystery. Because if homosexuality is exclusive, such that individuals who have have particular genes never reproduce, then that's a bit of a puzzle. And it's one of the pieces of argument for why homosexuality cannot possibly be genetic. But in fact, there are a number of things about this that are a bit misleading, because in fact, there are several scenarios under which homosexuality can be genetic, even if the individuals carrying the genes never reproduce. But when you look more broadly in animals, one of the difficulties is that you have to have long-term studies of the same animals in order to know whether or not a preference is a lifetime preference and precludes reproduction. And we have very little data about that. But we do know that in terms of sexual activity with members of the same sex, that's very common.
Okay, let's move on now to monogamy. And Dr. Tatiana comments that monogamy is one of the most deviant behaviors in biology. Why is that?
Dr. Tatiana has a very strict definition of monogamy. She wants to look at the cases where animals mate for life and don't cheat. It's something that many of us aspire to, and I think that it's a fair definition to investigate whether or not this is something that occurs, more generally, whether other animals fulfill the dream that many of us have. And, it was believed in 1968, a British ornithologist called David Lack wrote that 90% of birds were monogamous. And, and so we have this belief that this is a common thing for other animals and that it's something that we have difficulty with. But in fact, it's extremely uncommon for other animals. I could only find a few documented cases. And even those are you have to take them with a bit of a pinch of salt, because again, we don't have any long-term data. But the jackdaw, which is a small bird related to the crow, they appear to be monogamous throughout their lives. Black vultures, one of my favorite examples, black vultures seem to be monogamous. The California mouse, some insects, termites, for example. But it's extremely unusual. And what usually happens is that for at least one partner, probably both, you have a higher reproductive success, more children, if you're not faithful to an individual. So Dr. Tatiana investigates the circumstances under which, true monogamy can actually evolve. And there are circumstances, but they're not very common.
What does the persona of Dr. Tatiana allow you to do that you might not otherwise be able to do?
Well, I think that Dr. Tatiana, I created her as a playful experiment, and it turns out that having questions and answers in this sort of fashion, as she receives letters from organisms upset about their sex lives, it allows the natural history to be much more vivid, and it also when the organism asks a question, it leads into a serious scientific question. You know, for example, many organisms have extremely large sperm counts. They produce billions of sperm. The Australian splendid fairy wren, which is a tiny little bird, has an ejaculate of 8 billion sperm, which is a lot more than the average man makes, and yet this bird is absolutely tiny. And so, you know, there are serious questions about what sorts of forces lead to extremely large sperm counts, and it turns out that having mates who are likely to cheat on you is one of the main forces. And sure enough, the female splendid fairy wren has at least one lover as well as a husband, and often a male will be helping to rear chicks, none of which are his. And so the structure of the book allows discussion of serious questions while being much more accessible. At least that's what I was aiming for.
So now that this book has been out a little while and people have heard about it, and how have people reacted to you?
I've been having an entertaining time.
And has it at all played any role in your personal life?
Creating Dr. Tatiana and going through the material for this book has certainly been quite liberating. I feel that I'm much more comfortable about some of the things that I see in myself, and I think I'm more comfortable with being a primate.